FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and today is April 10th, 2017. It's Monday, and we're on with John Rubino. Good morning, John.
Morning, Kerry.
Hey, so we had a little bit of intercontinental fireworks display, talking about the cruise missile attack on Syria, which it doesn't seem to really be much other than a show of force, if you will. They're still flying planes out of the base, so they didn't intentionally destroy the whole thing. And there was an article that said, if you want to get the attention of a couple of monkeys, kill a chicken. So you think they were killing a chicken here, our president, or is it just his trigger finger was itchy and he had to try it out?
Well, Kerry, this could be anything from an incredibly complex false flag involving Russia and China and aimed at Iran and Saudi Arabia, or all the way over to Trump just waking up in a bad mood one day and seeing some video he didn't like and realizing that he could, instead of just talking about it, do something about it. You know, you give a narcissist cruise missiles and jet planes, and you got to figure they will occasionally do things on impulse. And so this could be that, or it could be something, as I said, way more complex and way scarier. And the thing about today's world is that there's no way to know. We can't tell a false flag from a legitimate event anymore because there have been so many of each. And It remains for historians to sort them out and tell our grandchildren which ones are false flags and which ones really happened because they should have happened. And in the moment, we can't know that, you know, and it's terrifying because it means we can't make good decisions about who to vote for and stuff if things are being made up out there with the at least partial goal of manipulating our opinion here, you know. And so I have no idea why that happened. And whether the supposed chemical weapons attack was really Assad attacking his people at a really strange, random time when you think about it, or somebody else stepping in and doing that and blaming it on Assad. So we just can't know. And to me, that's scarier than any other part of this story. You know, that there are battles going on in the Middle East is kind of something we're numb to by now. But if big players are making stuff up and then trying to fool us with the things they're making up, that to me is scarier, really, than things just naturally unfolding as people work out their differences. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, add it to the list of stuff that doesn't look quite right that's going on in the world today.
Yeah. Well, my inclination is that it was a false flag attack, but it didn't have to be. You know, they're going to do the Middle East. Anything can happen there. They've gassed their own people on numerous occasions. And, you know, this is why they, you know, I don't think at this point, John, we can just turn our backs and leave the place because they've got nukes now. Presumably they got chemical weapons. I think we're in too deep at this point. How do we just withdraw?
Well, see, that's the you know, on the right and the left, you have this concept of getting the country pregnant. You know, on the left, it's you start an entitlement program, small, but it can never be gotten rid of because once it begins, it has this constituency that will fight to the death to stop you from taking away their benefits. And the right wing version of that is to start a little war and get mired in it. But then you say, well, we can't leave because our credibility is intact. And that keeps us in these wars. And so as you described it, that's exactly right now. If we pull out, there are all kinds of possible risks involved in us just leaving this mess over there for those guys to sort out. And so the people in charge of it now can say with, you know, a certain amount of honesty, you know what, guys, we're committed. We have to stay the course here and try to make this work out. But you know what, Kerry, I don't think there's any way to make this work out. There's no happy ending that is even conceivable now in the Middle East, just because we have made such a gigantic mess of it. You know, we install these dictators who abuse their people, but suppress jihad, you know, the tendency of Muslim populations to elect Islamists when they get a chance to. But then we we get so disgusted with the behavior of the dictators that we've installed, we allow them to be overthrown. And then you get something like Egypt, where Islamists take over. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood gets elected. Right. They start doing away with the constitution. Then the military comes in, and now we're back to having a dictator again. You know, and it's that pattern that has no happy ending. There's no good outcome because we, beginning, you know, 100 years ago, this isn't a recent thing, but we've been screwing around in the Middle East since the days of, you know, Winston Churchill as the Lord of the Admiralty in World War I. You know, it's been going on for that long. And you can't understand the Middle East unless you go all the way back and see how, we drew these arbitrary lines in the sand and made countries that included one-third of one tribe and two-thirds of another tribe. And, you know, it's been fighting ever since. And then we overthrew the legitimately elected president of Iran in the 1950s and installed a dictator. You know, you have to go back to these things that we did a long time ago to understand the mess that the Middle East is today.
Yes.
And yeah, there's no
mess
fix.
It is.
And as you said, they're getting nuclear weapons. You know, those things are easier to get now than they've ever been. The technology is getting simpler and cleaner, and the amount of nuclear material that's floating around on the black market out there is growing all the time. And so there's no way for us to stop, for instance, Iran from getting nuclear-tipped ICBMs at some point in the not-too-distant future, unless we bomb them back to the Stone Age, in which case everybody who survives the bombing becomes jihadists and are willing to, suicide bomb our jet planes and our, you know, amusement parks and the Super Bowl and you name it. We'll have stuff like that happening going forward, which, you know, might be in the end a worse thing than a relatively stable Iranian regime with nuclear weapons. Although that's not a good thing either. You know, there's no way out of this that you can point to that 10 years from now gives us peace in the Middle East and tranquility everywhere else. It's just not possible. So in the end, the only solution might be to start space colonies.
So there's no happy ending. No happy ending, huh?
No, there really isn't, because it's a combination of past geopolitical mistakes and technology, weapons technology that's getting better and better all the time. So, you know, suitcase nukes are not science fiction anymore. And there's a story circulating online about the next generation of nukes that they're calling them micro nukes, that are like bullets and gun size weapons, but that contain, you know, radioactive material that can blow up and make a huge explosion. And when that happens, assuming that it hasn't yet, but when that happens, then all bets are off. Anyhow, that's where we're veering into really dark territory here. You know, that's even darker than the financial crisis we talk about all the time, Kerry.
Yeah, and they're kind of intertwined. Yeah, they really are, because you generally don't have major wars during times of real prosperity. Everyone wants to get along because they're making too much money to mess things up. But then when the pie starts shrinking, that's when countries stop getting along, right?
Mm-hmm. And then wars are insanely expensive, which means you got to borrow tons of money on top of what you borrowed to create the financial crisis, which led to the war. And you get this death spiral of global finances, which we're not far from that. I mean, give us something that requires another couple trillion in military spending on top of what we're doing already. And how could we not have a global currency crisis? You know, why would anybody want to hold the currencies of countries that are going so deeply in debt to finance this incredibly messy, never-ending war? You know, and see, that's one scenario where finance and geopolitics create a feedback loop that really amplifies our current problems. But, you know, it's got to be said that even in the absence of any kind of geopolitical issues that require massive military spending, we're still toast financially. You know, we've already borrowed all the money that we need to borrow to guarantee a huge crisis out there in the future. And it just becomes a question of timing, which is something I'm noticing in the comments section of a lot of gloom and doomy sites. People are getting kind of frustrated with, you know, the whole, you've been saying this.
Are we there yet?
2010, and it still hasn't happened yet.
Are we there yet?
I'm feeling that kind of prediction fatigue, where it's really getting kind of tiresome to go over this same territory continuously, because you know it's going to blow up eventually. But if it doesn't blow up for another 3 or 4 years, Kerry, can we keep talking about this? You know, can we have this same conversation over and over again, or do we need to move on to something?
But what if it doesn't blow up? If it does blow up, but you know, it's like a tree falls in a forest, but nobody ever reports it, and they just pretend that everything is normal. You know, emperor with no clothes type situation. What happens then?
Well, you know, it's possible that historians will date the beginning of this Great Depression at 2000.
Yeah.
And that they'll see today as the midpoint of a depression in which we used financial tricks to hide it. You know, food stamps, for instance, means that we can give food to, 55 million people without them having to stand in visible soup lines. You know, soup kitchen lines. So you don't see it. Mm-hmm. And the fact that people are leaving the workforce means that unemployment, as it's reported, isn't at depression level figures yet. But it would be if we were reporting everybody who leaves the workforce as unemployed. So we're using statistical and financial tricks to hide the fact that we kind of sort of are in a depression. And it's possible historians will say that we're already, 15 years into it, and that the next 15 years might be more visible, but they're just a continuation of what's already happened. So I don't know. You know what I'm going to start doing on dollarclass.com, though, Kerry, is a positive series of articles based on the book that I should be writing and will be pretty soon, called After the Crash. In other words, the crash is coming. Accept it or not, but it's going to happen pretty soon. And when it does, it's going to terrify the financial markets, and stuff is going to get very cheap. Yeah. You know, the things that are expensive today will get cheap. And at the same time, a lot of really interesting technologies are coming along. They will create the next level. Next generation of Googles and Apples. So we should be preparing now to understand these technologies and be able to judge them at the bottom of the cycle, when the stocks that are in those fields are insanely cheap, you know, pennies on the dollar. Mm-hmm. And so we can build the growth stock portfolio that builds a lot of capital going forward, coming out of the bottom of the next depression. And the first one I'm going to do is, of course, solar power, which is doing amazing things lately, you know. But there are a lot of other ones. So that's one way to make what's happening a little less scary, by focusing on the good things that are happening in the world. And they are really good things, you know, the regenerative medicine, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on and on, artificial intelligence, assuming AIs don't become sentient and give us a Terminator kind of scenario out there.
I doubt it.
They'll do a lot of good things before that happens.
Yeah, I think that's kind of ridiculous, but sci-fi. But you never know. I mean, I don't believe that machines really can develop a soul or consciousness. You know, it's just my personal opinion. Trying to find out the number of food stamp recipients here. I know a year ago it was 43 million, but nobody's talking about how many are getting it right now. Yeah, there's you're right. There is a lot happening with the technology. However, it's going to be a while before we have electric cars, before they're prevalent, because the infrastructure just isn't there to charge all these cars. The grid. Just not there.
See, that's from an investor standpoint, though, Kerry, that's a good thing, because that means you get growth for decades instead of years. Mm-hmm. If you have a huge infrastructure you got to build out, that means the numbers rise at a double-digit rate for as far as the eye can see. And stock markets love that kind of thing. If you can extrapolate double-digit growth to infinity, then you'll pay anything for that stock, right? And so you want to be owning that stock before the market concludes that infinite growth is the new normal, you know? And so maybe it's not Tesla, but did you see that Tesla just became the most valuable in terms of market cap car company in the U.S.?
Yeah, it just shows how irrational things are.
yeah. But see, that's a sign of what will come if electric cars work out. You know, if they become viable on a mass scale, then you'll see runs like Tesla just have, but you'll see it be sustainable. You know, Teslas may or may not be sustainable. It could go right back down just because people got overexcited lately and the hype will wear off. But at some point, the hype will be legitimate, at least in terms of growth rates and everything. Maybe not in stock prices, you know, because the stock price could just rocket when people get really excited and conclude that the growth rate that you've seen in the last 3 years is sustainable for the next 50. That's right. What you want. You know, you want to be there when that conclusion takes hold.
Yeah, it's just what company will actually be selling these cars. I'm not convinced that it's going to be Tesla by any stretch. No, it could be GM. Yeah, it probably will. And the amount of investment, though, John, to actually convert our transportation infrastructure from internal combustion engines, gasoline, diesel powered, to electric, it's staggering. I mean, you will have to rip up cities and towns to put in these new big trunk lines to charge everybody's car. You just can't picture. And it's not enough to say, oh, I'll just put up a row of solar cells and that will charge my car. It's not going to work. Not enough electric coming from the sun to do this. And certainly not in the foreseeable future, but if ever. I don't see it.
Carrie, I've got to beg to differ there. Solar power is plunging in price, and solar and wind together represent 55% of the new generating capacity coming online in the U.S. Mm. And remember, solar was like 1% of power generating capacity overall just a few years ago. And now it's half the new capacity. So we are adding massive amounts of solar generating capacity.
Well, I don't know about massive, but it's like, it's minuscule compared to the total amount of electricity generated. So without seeing something really take off where it's growing 100% a month, this thing's going to take forever, John, for the solar to replace it. And you just can't power these cars. There's a reason why gasoline became the motor fuel of choice. And it's not because of the Rockefellers, because they weren't really behind it. The reason why is because it transports more energy efficiently than anything else right now, up to date. And the transition is just going to be much slower and slavish than you think, because it just can't happen overnight.
Well, but see that, okay, but that, again, that's kind of my point. You don't want it to happen overnight. You want it to go at, you know, let's say 15% a year, which is very easy starting from such a low base with solar, and then have people extrapolate that 15% out for 20 or 30 years, because then you get an infinite stock price. That is going to be very easy with these new technologies that are basically starting from zero. You know, regenerative medicine has the entire pharmaceutical industry to run out of business.
That's great. That I love it. That's something. Yeah. I actually have a show coming on, hopefully sooner rather than later. About stem cell therapy.
Who
do you think is trying to run roughshod over the FDA to proclaim stem cells that come from your body to have them treated as a new drug and therefore hinder the adoption of it when, I mean, it's amazing what can be done.
Yeah. I mean, you would expect big pharma to stand in the way of this if they can.
I don't think they can, and I think they will adopt it, but.
Well, yeah, if they slowed down progress in stem cells in the U.S., we would all just fly to China or Europe or wherever they're not slowing down the progress. So some country would decide they have a competitive advantage and just jump into stem cells and make it legal, and every kind of experimental treatment is there and cheap. And so we would just become medical tourists. So the market would bypass regulation if that's what happened.
Yeah, I mean, look, the person I know, for $5,000, if you've got like bad rotator cuff, you got bad ligaments in your neck, rheumatoid arthritis, hip problems, you go for this for $5,000. It might have to go for a second one sometimes, or a third. But nonetheless, it's so much cheaper than a hip replacement operation if it works.
Oh my God.
And
yeah.
It works like 2/3 of the time.
And it gives you a real hip, not some chunk of metal where they chopped your bone off and stuck a piece of titanium in there or whatever. Yeah. It's infinitely better and less invasive than what we have now.
The guy I talked to is a doctor. He's a soccer player. He tore both of the meniscuses in both knees playing soccer, and he did the stem cells, and within 30 days he was playing soccer again, and within 6 months showed me the MRI. You could barely detect the tear. It wasn't there. That was miraculous, the body healing itself. We've always thought that it could do it, but now it's actually starting to do it, and that's what's what's remarkable.
Yeah. And see, that's something that that right now occupies 1/1000th of 1% of the related procedures for the stuff you just named.
Yeah.
So and if it's going to be 85% at some point in the future, somewhere out there, that's an astounding growth rate, you know? Uh-huh. And so the company that has the best technology, whatever that turns out to be, for regenerative kinds of procedures is going to be the next Google or the next Apple or whatever. Yeah. And so the question is, can we find that company? Can we understand that technology well enough to be able to separate that one or that handful of companies out from the 50 other ones that have promising stories? And that's the real intellectual challenge for a growth industry, because it's easy to see something as getting bigger over time, but it's hard to figure out who's going to be the, you know, is it going to be Apple or is it going to be Commodore, you know, mm-hmm. or one of the other big computer makers that we don't hear about anymore because they went out of business. Even though computers themselves became huge, you know, that it's a serious intellectual challenge, but it's really an exciting one because you're working with a world that's improving year after year, mm-hmm. instead of one that's going backwards like geopolitics is today or finance is today. You know, those are depressing stories. These technologies are really uplifting, positive stories.
Yes, they are, and it's happening. You know, it's happening pretty quickly, but. But as far as a transition from the way we generate electricity now to cars doing it, they're just going to require a lot of infrastructure investment, ripping up cities, you know, to put in these charging stations. Really will. Yeah, like my friend's got a Tesla. He says, yeah, it costs me $30 a month to charge it. And in theory, you should be charging them at night when the grid, the demands on the grid are lowest. But the reality is it's going to be a long time before everybody is driving an electric car.
Well, you want to hear one more interesting stat that's tangential to this market is that California now has so much solar generating capacity that that at peak periods, at peak sunny periods right now, electricity is free in parts of California because they're generating so much solar power. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you've got a Tesla, that's when you want to charge your car. Yeah. In the middle of the day,
yes.
When the sun is straight up above. And that's just the beginning. You know, they're still adding huge amounts of new solar capacity year after year after year. And mm-hmm. so it's changing exponentially, at least in really sunny places like California. It's going to push the other energy sources just right off the board in, you know, a decade or two, in a really short time in terms of cyclical time, you know, long wave time, which is 60 or 70 years for a technology to come online. This this is now at the point where one more decade and it's dominant.
Yeah, well, I think it's going to be a little bit more than that, John, but it's definitely going to happen. It's just going to happen, I think, slower than many optimists believe, because it's a huge monumental undertaking. Don't forget, our current electrical infrastructure has been built up over the past 130 years, and you know, it's been replaced at times, but this is it's a big undertaking. Everything mm-hmm. takes longer than you think. You know, it's one thing for you to put a DVR in your home to replace your DVD player or your video cassette recorder. You know, those have been gone a long time, but it's another thing to just replace and change the way everybody powers their vehicles. So we'll see what happens. But I do agree it's going to be a growth area. It's got a lot of attractive features to it. And when they do solve the battery riddle, that will make a big difference. When you can go 600 miles on a charge, then it's better than a tank of gas. And
oh, yeah.
That will be a big difference.
You're absolutely right. Batteries are the key to everything in clean technology. You know, when they come online, when they're twice as good as they are today, then that opens the floodgates. So it's a question of when that happens, you know?
Yeah, there was a guy who's 94 years old, and he just invented a better battery. Yeah, this inventor is amazing. A team of engineers led by this guy, I saw this article. I can't believe I missed it. 94-year-old John Goodenough. Isn't that a great name? Goodenough? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hey, I'm John. I'm Goodenough. Yeah. So at UT Austin, my son's alma mater, and it does away with lithium. It uses sodium, and which you can get from seawater. Let's face it, salt. It can hold more energy than lithium and never never wears out ever. So this could be the brass ring of alternative energy here. And I will send you a copy of that article, and I'll put a link up in the show notes as well. But this wasn't like this guy, I don't know if he won a Nobel Prize or not before, but he's been in technology his whole life, and everybody says he's genius to do it at 94 years old. Pretty damn good for him, huh?
Yeah.
Safer, faster charging, longer lasting rechargeable batteries for handheld mobile devices, electric cars, and stationary energy storage. So, you know, this could be it. And it only came out February 28th of this year, the release. And you know, I hope that I can do things like this when I'm 94, if I make it.
Well, keep doing those stem cell treatments, Gary.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I haven't started yet, but I'm going to.
About batteries, though, is that we didn't put much research effort into them for a really long time because they were good enough, you know, to run a car. The battery that starts your car hasn't really changed for 50 years. And then with the advent of cell phones and laptops, all of a sudden it became economic to start building smaller, more powerful batteries. And so it's happening. You know, we put a lot of research money and thrown a lot of brain cells at the question, and the results are predictable. You know, batteries are getting better and better year after year, and so we just need that breakthrough, like you just described right there to become scalable.
Yeah. Well, if you can, if you can harness save the energy from the wind and from the sun when it's coming, and then use it when you don't need it or when you don't have sun and wind, hey, that's the Rosetta Stone right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an amazing arbitrage when you think about it. In California, for instance, where solar is free for 3 hours a day, you build a big battery complex, buy that free electricity for nothing, and then sell it when the sun goes down for some much higher price. And so you make a really nice spread right there if the batteries are good enough and cheap enough.
Yeah, if.
That's
the if, but this looks...
Well, someday they will be.
This looks like the real thing. It genuinely does. We're going to find out soon. Anyway, John, that's it for this week. Find John's work over at dollarcollapse.com. Don't forget about John's podcast. And hey, send us an email, kl@carrielutz.com. That's kl@carrielutz.com. And Twitter feeds @CarrieLutz. The Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. John, till next week.
Thanks, Gary. Talk to you then.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.